As much as my work has exposed me to the worst of humanity, it's absolutely exposed me to the best of it as well. You know, a lot of the stories we do are feel-good celebrations of people who have given so much of themselves for the sake of others, or people who've defied the odds and beaten the odds and succeeded and achieved and recovered and all of that. And so we do at times get caught up in the negative, but there is so much positive in the job that I do that I think that helps me to keep a little balanced as well.
The juggle and the guilt is often the way that women who work refer to trying to have a fulfilling career that sets them up financially while at the same time raising children who are not wildlings. It's tough for anybody. But what's it like for a woman in the public eye, someone who's chosen a career where the general public feel free to scrutinise her every move? It's got to be tough. Today, I'm joined by Sylvia Jeffries. She's a very high-profile Australian journalist, and we're going to talk about how she manages just that, the things that she does to keep her resilient, and the sometimes very tough choices that she makes to protect herself and her family. Before we get to the chat, here's some ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss, plushcare.com/weightloss. If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss, plushcare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
G'day, this is Better Than Yesterday, helping you make today better than yesterday since 2013. Thanks for being a part of the show. My name's Oshie Ginsberg. I'm a podcaster. I'm a best-selling author. I'm a husband. I'm a dad. I'm a stepdad. I'm a Melbourne Comedy Festival, two-time Melbourne Comedy Festival producer and performer. I am an echoey high-rise service apartment dweller and communal sauna enthusiast. There's a massive sauna down on level 7. That's really humong. It's like you could fit 20 people in there. I don't know how comfortable it would be, but you could. And I'm grateful that you're here. Look, I'm still in Melbourne, so it's a bit echoey, but I'll be back in Sydney soon. And I just wanted to say thank you to everyone that came to the shows for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. It was absolutely brilliant stuff. A few thoughts about that on Monday. I was very sleepy because I realized I'd forgotten that I hadn't done it across the weekend, but I didn't want to leave you that podcast, so I threw that up. So apologies for my sleepy voice on Monday, but I've since become medicated, and I've since had coffee and a good night's sleep, and here I am. So thank you for being here. I'm about to drive back. I had some things to tie up in Melbourne before I headed home, so I'm about to drive back. Lots to think about, but I was asked the other night when I spoke about coming out of the Chinese restaurant at 2 a.m, ran into a bunch of other Sydney comedians on the street. Someone said, what are your thoughts on the run? I'm like, I know enough to not say anything at this point because I'm still in a tired and emotional phase. So I'm not going to make any judgment or make any decisions. I'm just going to notice these feelings and be with the good parts and the ungood parts. Ungood? Then I'll have a judgment or thought about it later. So yeah, I'm just kind of sitting with that, and that's probably what I'm going to do as I drive back to Sydney. There is one, we had a bunch of amazing special guests on the show. One person that's done the show, one of the original guest reporters, was Sylvia Jeffries. And she is my guest today. Sylvia Jeffries is an incredibly accomplished journalist and TV presenter. She's originally from my hometown of Brisbane, Australia, so of course I think she's awesome. Sylvia is a complete legend, and there's a matter-of-fact kind of get-after-it vibe about her, which just makes her career success, makes it make perfect sense. Once you kind of get to know her a little, you're like, well, of course you are where you are and do what you do. Sylvia is very open about how she juggles a family life and a home life, a professional life and a public life. And I found particularly interesting in our conversation the ways that she deliberately works in the emotional regulation into her day so that she is able to indeed go back home and connect with her kids in a meaningful way after exposing herself as a journalist to the unedited grim realities of the world. I certainly took something away from this conversation. I hope you do too. You're going to learn a lot about the news today. You're going to learn a lot about how we get our news, and you're going to learn a lot about someone who makes a thing called the news, what someone like that has to say about how you and I digest our news. It's really important to listen to that part. I'm grateful for it. She's excellent. I can't wait for you to get to know her. I was thrilled that she came around. This is Sylvia Jeffries. Thanks for coming around today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
It's so lovely to see you. And absolutely, on record, thank you for being the most champ of all champs when you came and did our news show.
Oh, I had the best time. It was such a buzz. It was such a buzz. And I remember being on the phone to my husband on the way home saying, that is the best fun I've had in ages. It was. It was so much fun. And you guys are just so talented and your team was so funny. I loved every minute of it.
And you, what was, because I came on your show to, I can't remember what I was there to talk about, but I pitched both you and David.
Yeah.
And you were just like, yes, I'm in.
I'll do it. Because there's a little part of me that's always wanted to be in the comedy world, in comedy land, just because I'm not funny. I'm not a funny person, but I am such a massive consumer of comedy. And I'm such a fan of people in that world, especially in the Aussie industry. We have the funniest people in the world in this country. So to be able to step into your world for like 5 minutes was such a treat.
Look, you were so great. And because of, for people who haven't seen the show, I always ask my guests to tell a story about something that could only ever happen in live television. You told the most magnificent story. And the callbacks that came throughout the whole show. It's such a treat because a whole part of the show for me is just pointing out just the preposterousness of this worksite.
Of skydiving live on television.
Well, that, but, you know, what things are okay in that context? Uh-huh. It's nuts.
It's nuts. This is why they make so many TV shows about breakfast television.
Well, there's one really prominent one.
Yes.
Which I remember when, I think in season one, I'm talking about Morning Wars.
Yeah.
In season one, when he reaches under the table and pushes the button that locks the door.
Yes.
And Audrey didn't know that was a thing.
Based on a real scenario.
On a real person who actually had that button.
Exactly.
That would actually lock the door from across the room.
Yes.
And he could lock people. It was probably there. Look, I don't want
it
people
It was sold
me.
As a something to help with convenience.
Yeah.
And security if there's ever an intruder. But of course, it was read as something much more sinister.
Yes. And So when I watch Morning Wars, I look at the dynamics of the control room and the producers and the jockeying of position for correspondence and things for that anchor role.
Mm.
And also all the other subtext about women in the workforce and men in positions of power and all that kind of stuff. And occasionally I, as a straight white bloke, go, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. I can't imagine what it's like watching that show for you.
Triggering. It is triggering. No. It is, do you know what? They I don't know who does the research on that show, but they, in terms of, as you say, the dynamics between control room, producers, floor managers, hair and makeup, and on air talent, in inverted commas, as you know, the hosts are called. It's accurate. It's a really, at times, true reflection of those dynamics in the workplace, from executives down. And it's just such a weird place. It's such a pressure cooker environment. It really is, because we're not talking about deadlines. We're talking about live TV, and you're doing things as it's breaking. It is a monster. It is a 24-hour monster. It's a machine putting a show like that to air as well. People are tired. They are sleep deprived, so they're extra edgy,
yeah,
which adds another dynamic to it all. So it's a wild kind of environment to work in. It's really exciting, and the energy is palpable, but it can be full on. It can be really full on.
Oh, no doubt. And as I am fond of saying, it's the most exciting time to be working in television.
It is.
It's also the most terrifying time to be working in television, depending on your outlook and how into pivoting you are.
True, yes, and how much you enjoy changing gears. It is. I think you're spot on when you say it's the most exciting time. That early morning shift is really exciting from a news perspective, which sounds odd to people outside of the news. We speak in such an internal language at times, you know, I think with news and media, but it is adrenaline inducing in that you wake up and there's all this stuff that's happened overnight, often overseas, sometimes here at home as well. And in a environment, in a time when we have 24-hour news cycles and people probably feel like they're getting the same news over and over and over, you get a clean slate. You get a clean slate of news that people haven't heard about for several hours while they've been asleep. So you kind of get to attack at it with a fresh angle, with fresh eyes, with fresh information. And I think in the current media landscape, there's something exciting about that, being able to dive into something new and fresh. But if you love live broadcast, then that's the show for you. You know, man, that slot is for you because it is so dynamic, and you constantly have to be on your toes.
There's nothing like live. It's it's very expensive. A lot of people tend to not do it anymore because it's because it is so expensive, which is it's a drag. I'm good at a very small amount of things. Unfortunately, they're very expensive things for other people to put on. But if you have me involved, I'll make sure that expensive thing is on time.
You can ring
goes
up
goes well.
Yeah.
And at the best of my capacity will rate as high as I could possibly get it to go there.
Yeah.
Were you fascinated with news? Were you fascinated with broadcast? We grew up in Brisbane.
Yes.
It's less so in Sydney, I guess, but in Brisbane, the highest point that anyone can see, you can stand on Moreton Island. Mm-hmm. The highest point that anyone can see to the horizon is these four towers on top of this hill.
Uh-huh.
And there they are.
Yeah.
They are like standing over you. Like in Christmas time, one of them lights up like a Christmas tree.
Yes.
Like this 400 meter high. It's unbelievable.
It's like they're summoning you into their orbit and constantly in Brisbane.
As a kid, it was just this magic.
Yeah.
Where I grew up, they were behind our house. So we'd see them on the way home. But you're on the south side, you're in Cooperoo, right?
Yeah.
So you could see them everywhere you looked.
Yeah.
When did you kind of get an idea about the kind of sparkliness about television?
Growing up, I grew up in a very politically engaged family, I would say. So I watched a lot of news growing up as a kid.
Were your parents in the gig? Were they in the game?
My dad was on local council, was on Brisbane City Council.
Whoa. Which is the biggest city council in the country.
In maybe the Southern Hemisphere.
It's the largest.
Huge council.
It was the biggest in the world. It's this entire city.
Yeah. So he was the councillor, the alderman, they used to call them back then, for Whites Hill.
Oh, wow.
So I grew up, in a very...
Who did he serve under? Sally Ann or Jim?
He was Sally Ann. Yeah, so he's still very close with Sally Ann.
So he was with the team. He was the Sally Ann Cairn with her team. He was the team.
He had a core flute that said, "He cares." And I remember seeing someone vandalise one of those core flutes outside my uncle's house once, and they wrote "Who Cares" over the top of it. And that was my first insight into how nasty politics could be. And I thought, why would someone do that to my poor dad? He does care, you know? So,
wow.
Anyway, and then my mum is very much on the opposite end of the political spectrum to my dad. So I've been exposed to both sides of politics throughout my upbringing. So was always very aware and engaged with news and politics throughout my childhood. but was always drawn to journalism. I actually wrote a couple of newspaper articles for the Courier Mail education section when I was still in high school.
Wow.
About, you know, the trials and tribulations of being a teenager in Brisbane in the 90s and early 2000s, how to match your okonuis to your deck shoes, and, you know, all that kind of hard-hitting
hard
stuff. So clearly caught the attention of some important people back then. But I got a job in the Channel 9 newsroom in my first year of uni. So I got a job, an entry-level job, rolling auto cue and running news scripts to Heather Ford and Bruce Page, who grown up watching, you know, as a child. So, and I can honestly say, hand on heart, the moment I stepped into that newsroom, I knew that's where I wanted to be.
Wow.
I got the buzz, I got the adrenaline, I got the energy, the dynamic of a newsroom on that first day, and I didn't look back. I didn't want to leave.
So there's two things that I kind of want to unpack a bit. Mm. So Sally Ann Atkinson, Jim and I did a podcast a while back. It's still out there, but we don't do it regularly anymore. Mm. And we had Sally Ann on as a guest to talk about the 92 Brisbane Olympic bid, which Sally Ann Atkinson really went for and quite clearly said something along the lines of, like, if only we'd bought more mink coats for the wives of the guys, we would have had the Olympics 40 years before we're getting it now. Pretty clear. Like, she talked about that night in Paris and how it was very clear that we would really down on the gift giving.
Yeah, right. dropped a ball.
And the bit of the swag.
Yeah, right.
But she was local politics and state and federal politics. You can have like a liberal city council. Mm. It's anti-Australian, you know, Liberal Party. They're very different to the state and even more different to the federal. So your dad was kind of on that kind of economically conservative, righty kind of side?
Yeah, but very socially progressive, my dad. He sort of introduced the first recycling program to Brisbane and
things
like
that. Well, thank you. So I love getting my extra wheelie bin.
Exactly.
It was awesome.
He's very heritage conscious as well. He heritage listed some items in the area. He's my dad is just community first, and he always has been, and that's been something that he's really
Did he go overseas on
us.
A junket to look at the wheelie bin trucks
I'm
and all that?
I'm not sure about that, actually.
That's amazing.
I haven't asked him about junkets.
Because I'm old enough. We had the Oscar the Grouch tins at the side of the house, right?
I remember.
And the guys would run up behind your house to come and grab them, and they would sometimes split, and if your bag splits, the boys aren't picking it up.
You're done. Yeah,
and then
fair
you got,
enough,
you know,
too.
It's Brisbane, it's the summer, there's maggots. Like,
you're
horrible.
Not going through that, no.
And so when the wheelie bins showed up, it was this, oh my God, there's a robot that comes every week.
Yeah.
So that's incredible. So yeah, it's interesting that you know, now the conservative or the centrist politics is barely existent.
Yeah.
Whereas you can be economically conservative and socially progressive.
Exactly.
And that was that is people that held power in Brisbane for so long.
Yeah. Well, I would say at a council level, you probably still see that
a
lot more than you probably do on a federal level.
Yeah.
And council is such an interesting, you know, local government is such an interesting level of government because it is very grassroots and it's very connected with the community. I've had a really interesting insight, I think, into that world through that connection with Dad. But I majored in political science at university I'd had such strong influence.
Yeah, and so your mum was like on the other side.
Mum's
was she
the
like
other side.
Felt
yeah.
hat, you know, I, kind of. I was at the go-betweens gig. You don't know anything.
I saw
the Saints.
Do you know my mum?
Was it that?
Yes.
Was it, I know Grant McLennan, was it that sort of thing? Your dad could have been the guy from, was it that
look,
sort of thing?
It's very complicated. But yes, mum is.
Did she ever get arrested under a National Party protest against Bjelke
Petersen?
No,
She's never been arrested.
But she protested.
But she has owned a felt hat.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But she was, I guessing, like, if she's vociferous, and bear in mind that Brisbane was under the quite a nasty, intense conservative rule of the National Party for a long time, 22 years. Queensland itself was an awful place to be.
Mm.
And there was a lot of people protesting.
Yeah.
And you couldn't really do any kind of any student work without being somewhat politically involved because your life was so directly impacted by these policies.
Yes.
So your mum grew up in the middle of that.
Well, yes, but my mum also grew up in a Liberal Party family.
Wow.
So, and actually they met at a Young Liberals function. That's how my parents met.
I love it.
But she obviously over time developed very different ideas politically.
Yeah.
But that's why I chose to do political science at university because I thought, well, I'm going to figure out this stuff for myself. And so, majored in politics at university.
How did they model disagreement then?
My parents, yeah. Well, they split up when I was three, so that's how they modeled
well.
It.
Ah.
So they separated when I was about 3 years old. So I suppose that's how they modeled disagreement.
Yeah. Okay.
In total separation. We're very close to both our mum and our dad. And we all do a lot of stuff together these days. And, you know, so I think we've had a lot of lessons in all of that throughout our lives.
Yeah, we all figure it out.
So we
as
all
adults,
figure it
it's
out.
Easier to kind of sort it out when you can see each other as adults and those power structures are somewhat downgraded that never unfortunately ever get removed.
Yes.
It's a bit easier to kind of
it gets a bit
sort
easier.
Out.
Exactly.
And they can go, I did the best I could.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
And that's it. And then you become an adult and you're like, geez, this parenting stuff is really hard, isn't it?
I get
Life
it.
Life is hard.
It's okay. I can figure this part out. It's all right. It's not your fault.
They're
you didn't know it.
Best.
It's fine.
We can't blame our parents for everything.
No.
We can't do it.
Nor
should we.
But then if we do, then we're asking them to fix it. And then we never get to become an adult.
We've got to sort it out for ourselves.
Have to.
Yeah.
So you mentioned two news anchors and you, on the way in, you met Georgia who's, I think she's at uni. I don't know.
Yeah.
She's having a break. She teaches in the morning and the afternoon and she has uni. I don't think she could name one news anchor.
Yeah, right.
All right. She's 20.
Yeah.
And that's where we are when people get their news.
Yeah.
She's very informed, but she doesn't watch anything.
Where does she get her news?
TikTok.
Yeah.
And Instagram. That's where she gets her news.
Yeah.
That's where she gets her news. But at the time you're talking about, there's a reason that Ron Burgundy's Anchorman is so funny because it literally was that.
They were superstars.
It was.
Yeah.
I had a signed 8x10 Mike Higgins. I think like I must remember something like that.
Mm.
When you walk into that newsroom and it's buzzing and it's, you know, typewriters noises and, you know, dot matrix
they
printers.
They weren't typewriters when I started Osher.
Well, the fax
but
machine
they were tapes.
The fax machine made a noise. I know that for a fact.
Definitely.
And there's that ticking clock.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
What, there's a person that we don't really hear about much and their name is generally referred to as the news boss.
Mm.
All right. They're the person who calls it.
Yeah.
What do you remember? Did you ever get to see any of those meetings? Do you ever, you know, remember, okay, these, because there's only 8 slots or 10 slots for a night.
Yeah.
This is what we're going to go with tonight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember those meetings. I used to sit in on them all the time. You learn to develop a thick skin very quickly. There's no time to beat around the bush. And there was a little more aggro, I would say, in the newsroom.
Not the small puppet who is delivering cartoons two doors down at Channel 7 in the morning.
No,
the weekend.
Exactly. No. Yes.
And, different kind of aggro.
A very different kind of aggro.
Yeah, yeah.
I think things are a lot different these days in that respect. I was probably coming in on the edge of that kind of stuff.
Oh, right, yeah.
I would say. But it's just no nonsense, you know, and I think you come out of high school and I was in the early stages of university where you're probably mollycoddled a little bit at that point in your life.
Yeah.
So it was definitely an awakening stepping into newsroom meetings as a 19-year-old as well, first year of uni. But, you know, I made some friends in there really quickly and had a little support network and they're still some of my best friends today. And, yeah, it was a really great environment. It was a really exciting environment as a 19-year-old to be in.
What did you learn about television or working in this space in that role that you still like use today?
Oh, everything. Never assume. Ron Kruger, my executive producer, he was the executive producer at the time at QDQ, as we call it, Channel 9 in Queensland. And he'd been there for a long time when I started. And one of my jobs was to type out and time the superbars that go at the bottom of the screen. So it would say, back then, John Howard, Prime Minister, and I would have to put the correct timings in for them. And if I made a spelling mistake on that superbar, I would get a very stern lecture afterwards about why you can never make a mistake as seemingly small as that in the 6 p.m. news. And if I made an assumption on something and it was incorrect, I would get a lecture on why you never assume in the news business. And they're all lessons I needed to learn as a 19-year-old and as a 20-year-old in that newsroom. And it sticks with me. I can hear Ron's voice. And Ron was a gentleman. He really was. And I can hear his voice every time I face an issue like that in the newsroom still today or in my job today at Today Extra. I hear his voice in my head saying, never assume, never assume. And it's always with me. And it served me throughout my career.
in this time where people who aren't journalists have access to scale at sometimes well beyond any broadcast licensee owner.
Yeah.
You know, someone can literally turn their camera around on their phone and talk at it and say some stuff that might not be factually correct. It's emphatic and convincing, but not real.
But that doesn't mean it's real or true. Yeah.
They don't have that.
Yeah. I can't wrap my head around some of the gossip podcasts and accounts online that perpetuate gossip, and they do it freely and they do it without any checks, without any verification. And they have disclaimers saying none of these statements have been verified, but then they go on to discuss them freely and openly. And to me, that's really dangerous because you hear that and people want to believe the gossip they hear because it's salacious and it's interesting and it gives them something to talk about at work or at home or whatever. And I find it fascinating that these organizations and these groups, sometimes just individuals, can do that so freely because it's so against everything we've been taught as journalists. I mean, they're not journalists and they're not claiming to be, but they are handling really significant information in a really amateur way and at times irresponsible way. Look at what's going on with Princess Kate at the moment. I went down that wormhole.
Wow. So as we're recording this, this is the time of history where a very poorly used Photoshop clone brush set off a chain reaction of the deep state's taking over the UK conspiracy shit.
Yeah, yeah. And the rumors swirling around that, some of them are very damaging if, you know, they're damaging as rumors.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting that, and I find it
a little
bit
worrying.
Oh, they
learned their lesson with Princess Di. They learned their lesson with Harry and Will.
I mean, that's another angle, right, on the story is,
No, they fucking didn't. No, man.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really worried. At this point in time, I have a lot of sympathy and concern for Kate. I think the fact that she had to step up and issue an apology, if she did, I don't know if she, I mean, can we be absolutely sure, again, never assume, that she did issue that apology on the Princess and Princess of Wales Instagram account. There would be minders who would have access to that account. But the big picture is that she's the one who's taken the fall for all of that at a time when she's recovering from major surgery and no one else is stepping in to protect her or defend her. And that, to me, reeks of what you're saying, that this has so many shades of Diana. We've digressed massively from what we were talking about.
But it's important because you are someone who's at the you are at the face. You're at the if we're a tunnel boring machine, you're at the cutter head, the thing that's pushing its way through, digging the Clem Jones tunnel. I watch a lot of tunnel boring machines on YouTube.
You've
man.
Got a lot
Wolfgang.
Of a lot of deep Brisbane references.
We
too.
Watch. I'm all about the deep cuts.
Yeah,
love you, Brisbane.
I love you, Brisbane.
You mean the world to me. It's the idea that even in local Australian media, whether you're talking about a footy player or someone who you might have seen on a reality show, or even someone who's just got an Instagram, all right, you're saying stuff about them that is unverifiable and set up in such a way that if they defend themselves, you're like, well, they would say that. Like the idea that, oh, they're in the public eye, they deserve it. Maybe if they work for a major network that has those walls of protection, because, you know, people don't like to talk about it, but it's true. People show up to your house. All right. You got to be really, really careful. And any TV network has that. They have the layers of security and things around the people that are in the public eye. These people have none of that, right? There are sometimes kids involved.
Exactly. Yeah.
What, for a couple of thousand podcast clicks?
Yeah.
Is it worth it? And is that person, like, what I always kind of look back at how journalism started and how those codes of ethics started, because there were riots once printing presses became available. People were printing anything because there was such a dearth of information, and particularly throwing mistruths into uncertainty, particularly around food availability or whatever. There were food riots, so people getting trampled, people were dying. Mm. And they went, hang on, we should probably really, like, if you own one of these machines that can print a lot of things in a hurry, you kind of have to be
a bit
responsible,
more discerning
it.
In how you use it.
And that's vanishing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there are still so many great journalists out there doing great work, but there are all these new platforms on which people find their news, And so it's getting much harder to tell who to trust and who not to trust. And that's the big challenge that we face. That and, you know, the likes of Meta just plucking all that money out and creating, I mean, that's an existential issue for journalism.
For democracy.
It really is.
I mean, we could sit here and talk about it. So how do you raise the children as a woman who works in town?
Oh, yeah.
No, we'll get to that part. Don't worry, we'll get to that part. We'll get to that
part. Oh, you know, it's a juggling act.
It's the juggle and the guilt. We'll get to that. But it's not just that. Yeah, it's exactly that. It's democracy itself. It's the actual viability of us to, as a community, make a choice that is the best thing for everyone here.
Yeah.
Up against the short-term interests of an incredibly small group of people, which more and more are able to be bought. Those eyeballs are able to be bought.
Yeah.
And it's really frightening.
It is frightening.
I don't know I don't know what we're going to do about it.
I don't know. I wish I had the answers. I absolutely don't. But, you know, thankfully, I work with an organization that is large in scale and wide in scope as well, in terms of publishing, digital, broadcast, radio, all of it. So there is a lot of strength and support behind what we do at Nine, and that's a really great place to be as a journalist.
It is. It's interesting, as you mentioned, is the money getting sucked out of the industry. The news is always been a product, but it was able to pay for itself with advertising, and people didn't really kind of notice how much it cost.
You
look at like some of those, you know, great movies from the 70s where it's got the big wide ties and it's just the cacophony of typewriters. It's like, there's 200 people in a newsroom. That's 200 people, their wages, their supers, and that's just that floor.
Yep.
Right? These are really expensive places to run. That's how much it costs to have verifying capacity.
And legal support as well, you know, when there are defamation cases and the rest of it that need to be defended. It's an expensive business.
The cost of truth was masked from the end user. Yeah. And now as we are, oh, you've already had your one free article. No, we're not going to let you. If you want to subscribe, you can subscribe.
Yeah.
I'm going to go find it free somewhere.
Exactly.
You know?
Because it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then if you're looking for the lowest barrier to any kind of answer to your question, beyond any, with no paywall, you might not actually find reality.
You'll get the surface.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's frightening.
Yeah. Anyway, lots of encouraging things, you know.
But it's just, but again, though, this is where, you know, people like yourself and the network you work for rapidly figuring out how do we maintain this.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's lost on those really big news organizations.
There are people much smarter than me figuring out how to deal with all of that. And I've no doubt that they will find a way around it. News is never going anywhere, right?
No.
Everyone wants news from trusted sources, and they will always want news from trusted sources. That's never going anywhere. It's about changing the model within which we work and making it sustainable. And there are people, like I say, much smarter than me who are figuring that out. I'm an optimist, Osha. I like to believe that there will be a solution.
I have to be an optimist because all we have is now.
Yeah.
It's all we have. And we can plan for an outcome that's not favorable. But if we act as if the unfavorable outcome is the inevitable, then our life is just misery.
Correct.
We can be ready.
Yeah.
But we can, you know, live as if it's going to be okay.
Yeah. It's going to be okay.
It's a better way to do
it. It's going
to
be okay.
You're 19, you're first year uni, you're in a big kind of newsroom that's probably just about to experience a fair amount of change. So there's probably still guys hanging on from the 70s and 80s that are in positions of power, men.
Yeah.
What did your experiences being a young woman in that space, how did that inform when you found out you were having boys?
Interesting. Wow. How did my time early on in the industry inform my approach to being a mother of boys?
Yes.
I think I wouldn't say that time specifically has come up for me. But
your experience in the industry.
I think my experience in life on the whole has informed my approach to mothering boys, to raising boys. And I think a lot of that, you know, put the internal stuff aside, being in the newsroom, being a journalist, and I suppose having witnessed some pretty dark things over the years, some distressing things, being in that bubble of news where it's a lot of doom and gloom at times has maybe given me a certain perspective on things. My time in the newsroom early on as a 19-year-old, there were some challenges for me. There were some moments, there's some moments that were maybe uncomfortable. And I would say I felt probably conscious of how I felt in that dynamic, being a young girl at that stage, 19 years old, in a room, in a newsroom that was predominantly male. I would say, though, I actually had a lot of support. The news director at the time, Lee, was very supportive of me. He had daughters a similar age to me, and so I felt really nurtured by him in many ways. I mentioned Ron as well, Paul Reed, who was the chief of staff, also very caring towards me. And so I actually had a really positive experience at that early stage in my career. You always feel probably small, I think, as a young woman stepping into that world in many ways, and it can take a long time to build up your confidence in that kind of space, a very robust environment. But I had a lot of support early on, and I think I don't know how that's informed me as a mother, but it's definitely I was modeled some really good behavior, I think, in those early days. It hasn't always been perfect, you know. Yeah. I think like any industry, like any newsroom, it hasn't always been perfect. And I have felt reduced by people at times in my career, and I have felt undermined by people. But I started at a time as well when there were a lot of women coming up through the ranks.
Yeah.
So I had a safe harbor. Wherever I've been in my career, I've had a safe harbour of support and friendship and people looking after me. And so that has helped me immensely throughout my life.
Just a moment away from Sylvia Jeffries to say, if this podcast brings you value, please share it with a friend. Hit the hamburger in the corner or the arrow or the three dots or whatever it is to share this episode with somebody, or, you know, copy the link and put it in an email or whatever. Tell someone about it. Or you please also subscribe where you can, rate where you can, review the show wherever you can. All that stuff helps us. Doesn't cost you anything to do, and it really helps us. So thank you so much if you have already, and please consider it if you haven't. It's really good because people come and go from the subscriber feed all the time. It really helps having, you know, people will listen to a podcast their friend told them about. So please be that friend. That would really help us a lot. We're back in a minute with Sylvia Jeffries.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Being a cop, being an ambo, there's only so many DV things you can show up to before you start to lose hope or start to not be able to accept that your daughter is now sexually active. Like like at some point you're going to have to sort that through, you know, because I've known people who have been in these gigs and they just get worn down by it.
Yeah.
Being a journalist, covering some of the darker aspects of masculinity, being aware of what can happen, and the good side as well, but also, you know, the news doesn't cover the people that got home safely.
Yeah.
The news, you follow the car crash. When you realised we're having boys.
Yeah.
with that background, was there a, you know, did you have an outlook of like, all right, these guys are moving into a world of, you know, how did you have an idea of how you wanted these boys to be?
If I'm entirely honest, my first thought was no one's going to call me when they get old and move on, you know, because I'm having boys. See, girls are the rock. But once I got past that very selfish thought,
I can't call my mum all the time. What are you talking about?
I don't know. I just worry. Well, maybe it's because I call my mother-in-law more than my husband does. So maybe that's what sets the scene. But there is definitely an element of being hyper aware and sometimes too aware, and maybe I'm too conscious of the worst case scenario at times. And so I worry too much. I definitely worry about my boys because I have seen, you know, the worst of humanity.
Early 2000s, but that's like that's all the King Hits in the Valley and all that kind of stuff.
Well, it was also a time when there was a serial sex predator on the loose in Brisbane attacking women out for runs on their own along the riverbanks.
Yeah.
And so that was a time when women couldn't run alone. And again, we're having that same discussion this year off the back of the Samantha Murphy case. So I would say there's an element of my work life having an impact on me with my boys in that way, but there's also just my upbringing, I think, with a very matriarchal family influence. Mm-hmm. My mother's a very strong woman, a very independent woman, and so that that female independence is very strong in my family, family's DNA. And so I'd say it's a little column A, it's a little column B. But, you know, as much as my work has exposed me to the worst of humanity, it's absolutely exposed me to the best of it as well. You know, a lot of the stories we do are feel-good celebrations of people who have given so much of themselves for the sake of others, or people who've defied the odds and beaten the odds and succeeded and achieved and recovered and all of that. And so we do at times get caught up in the negative, but there is so much positive in the job that I do that I think that helps me to keep a little balanced as well. Yeah.
When you, when the first child comes along, like no one has any idea.
There's no way to describe it.
You might have had, even you might have been really quite the oldest of five and seen, you know, I remember changing my youngest brother's nappies, right? That doesn't mean I have experience in parenting this one.
Yeah.
Because on the day of their birth, me and Audrey have exactly the same parent experience with this child.
Yeah.
You know, every child comes with different challenges. Did you and your husband kind of have a chat about how you wanted things to go beforehand? Did you figure it out as you went?
Oh, we absolutely figured it out as we went along. I think Pete and I are very fortunate. We're very much on the same page with all the important things.
Yeah.
And so we're very much in sync with a lot of those things. And we both had really similar upbringings as well. We've sort of tread a similar path in life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really helps because we have the same values and principles and hopes and things for the future. So we arrived day one with Oscar, and I think we were totally hit for six in every possible way. No one can prepare you for how much your heart grows and kind of explodes out of your chest. No one can prepare you for the exhaustion and the torture of sleep deprivation, but also that overwhelming feeling of, can I do this? And am I up to it? Am I doing the right thing? And it was the times when my mum or my sister or Pete would just simply say, you're doing a great job. And I would burst into tears because that's all you want to hear. You want to hear someone say, yeah, you're doing the right thing. You're doing a great job. And it was just such a wild mix of emotions and just intense, intense emotions at that time.
It's a lot of pressure, because somehow my phone figures out that I have a newborn.
Oh my God, it's the feed.
And then
it's constant.
this is Oliver, and Oliver's 9 months old. Yeah. He's spelling his alphabet already. It's shown that, you know, if you get the 9 months old to do the dishes, it sets him up for a great life. This is me having a nap in the middle of the day while he folds laundry. Like, fuck off. It's like, it's the same like when they figure out how old I am, and then they show me a photo of a bloke who's my age with way less body fat. I'm like,
stop it. Stop trolling me.
I don't want this.
I know.
It's a great resource.
Yeah.
I can go, it's actually a pretty good idea of how to figure out how to get him to not watch his show.
Yeah, this is the balance though, right?
Yeah.
Because once you show a little interest in parenting content,
forget it.
Your algorithm is flooded with parenting comments and content. And you are being told every time you open Instagram that you're doing it wrong and you could be doing it better. And here are 1,000 examples of why you're stuffing it up. Oh. And so you feel useless. You feel totally useless. Actually, the best advice I've heard was from Jen. So Jen came on our show recently. She's a parenting expert who teaches one-on-one with a lot of parents. And she said, if you are doing it right 30% of the time, you're doing well. And that was all I needed to have this enormous weight off my shoulders to think, okay, I'm aware of what probably best practice is here.
Yeah.
I'm not always going to be having a great day, so I'm probably not always going to have the mental capacity to do it right. Mm. But if I'm doing it right 30% of the time, then that's kind of cool. That's achievable. You know, I can do that without sending myself to the parenting asylum. I think that's okay.
Are absolutely right about just sitting there having a cup of tea, scrolling, and like, I've ruined his life.
I know.
What have I done to my teenager?
How much am I going to have to spend on therapy when they're older? Like, what have I done?
When it comes to Instagram, I mean, some people, everyone chooses their own thing, right?
Yes, yeah.
Through the job that I do, I know people who are in the public eye.
Yeah.
All right, and some of those people, they choose to have their children on their feed all day, all night.
Yeah.
Some of those people have their children star in their sketches they make.
Yeah.
Some of those people obfuscate their children's faces.
Mm.
Some of the people don't have their kids in there at all.
Yeah.
I'm like Wolf's in here or there.
Yeah.
G's in there, here or there. It's like maybe once every 6 months or so.
Yeah.
I can put a photo of him up and the likes just flood me.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
it's great. They're great content.
I don't like about that. No, I don't know about that. Because
no,
you don't give it two shits about the next thing I posted.
That's
so
right.
Yeah, he doesn't have it. Did you guys have a chat about whether or not you're going to identify your kids online?
So we did, absolutely, yeah. And at first, when they were babies, we shared images of them. A bit over a year ago, we decided to stop.
Right.
So we occasionally show images that aren't identifiable if they're, you know, from behind or whatever. But a little over a year ago, we decided to stop sharing images of them online. They're getting a little older now and they're approaching school age. Mm. And so it's for a number of reasons. I think, this feeds into the previous question. I've done a lot of work with New South Wales Police around child protection. And so that's probably partly informed my decision.
Yep.
And also just from a privacy perspective and their own entitlement to their own identity as well, which I know sounds, I don't know if we're overthinking it and some people probably roll their eyes at that, but I want my kids to be able to go to school and not have anything predetermined for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to also overestimate how much people follow us and are aware of us and are interested in us. But I think we have to be realistic about the fact that there will be some people who follow us online, who know our children and see them and feel comfortable enough to go up and say hello to them in the street if they're waiting up. And I get why, and that's a friendly thing and I get that, but for my children, that will become uncomfortable and odd and strange. And so I'm an overthinker and I'm definitely a worrywart. I know I'm a worrywart, but I want to protect them from some of those weird things that they may be confronted with.
And that's fair enough.
Track.
Do you talk to them about when people come and say hello to you? Do you talk to them about, how do you know them?
They're still a bit, they're not really aware. So Oscar's 4, Henry's almost 3. So they're not really aware of that yet.
Yeah, wow. Back to back.
People
Jesus Christ.
Oh, not on purpose. That was a happy
13
fluke.
13 months, 14 months?
14 months apart. IVF the first time and then happy fluke the second time.
Wow. Yep. So the floodgate, I got to figure that out.
We know what to do. Let's go.
Yeah. It works. We're away. And what are you going to do? Are you going to say no? No, of course not.
Of course not.
No. Sorry, remember that mat leave? Yeah. Going to need a bit more of that if you don't mind.
I'd been back at work for 4 weeks when I fell pregnant.
Brilliant.
So that was not the plan. But anyway, but we were, having done IVF the first time,
yeah. How
lucky are we that we didn't have to go through that again the second time? So absolutely no complaints.
Yeah.
We always wanted a second and we didn't have to work so hard at it.
Yeah, that's time, so I'm happy lucky. For you. I'm happy for you. It is when, because Wolf started to ask me, how do you know them, Dad?
Yeah, right.
I'm like, oh, remember when you came to, remember how you came to Masked Singer that day?
Yeah.
He said, well, people watch that at home on the TV and I think they saw me there. And I tell them when I first got on telly, like Channel V, like in 99, right, people would start to call my name, but they have a tone in their voice that they know me.
Yeah.
And so I turn around, I'm like, that person clearly knows me because they know I was Andrew back then. Yeah, and I'm like, oh, I must know you.
Yeah.
Because you've used that tone of your voice that is familiar.
Yes.
And then we chat for a second and then to be like, oh, no, you don't know me, man. I'm just, okay.
Yeah.
And I figured that, that was for me, it was a sign that I'm doing my job well, that
they
feel.
And it's much better than the alternative when they're heckling you at the pub.
That does happen. That did happen. That did happen.
Yeah.
But as Wolfie gets older, it's, it's kind of interesting.
It's something that, the parenting podcasters aren't feeding me that on Instagram, advice on that on Instagram. But it's something that we talked a lot about.
Yeah.
And we actively decided to share images of them at first because we're both very open with our lives and it felt so natural to share the most important thing in our lives, right? Like I said, now that they're getting a little older and more identifiable, I think, we made the decision to do that.
And like the kids at school, they'll figure out who mum and dad is.
Yeah.
And they might say some stuff, but it'll be
but they don't want to see photos
benign.
Of them sitting on the toilet from when they were,
No, you're precisely right. People don't want to go back in time and see them. There you are nude in the bath.
That's right.
You don't want that. When you are working in the space you're working in, and you mentioned the case of the jogger down in Ballarat who's gone missing. They still haven't found her,
haven't found her.
It's terrible, right? Mm. And after I met Georgia, it happened, she was 10 when I showed up, right?
Mm.
I was fine.
Mm.
Then I meet Georgia, a couple short weeks go by, and then I'm crying at a TVC. I'm just crying at an ad that has a kid in it. And that's a sign that my heart has switched over.
Totally.
And now it's only just about protecting her. So do you, since kids have come along, do you find some aspects of your work harder?
Totally. Yeah, totally. There have been times, I'm so fortunate. I work with David Campbell, who is the most emotionally intuitive person you've ever met.
Yeah.
And if he can see me struggling with something, he'll step in and save me. But we're both incredibly emotional people. And so we're both very aware of one another's triggers, I suppose. But if there's anything in the news about a child, I find it really hard now to cope. So I have to work harder at sort of disassociating from those things when we're in the middle of it. It becomes really challenging. I think it's such a difficult balance in journalism because, of course, you have to remove yourself from the stories that you're reporting on. But at the same time, you have to have empathy as a human being to be a good journalist as well. You have to understand what is at the heart of a story. What is it what is the human element of this story?
Yeah.
And so you have to find a balance between engaging with the humanity of something, but also disassociating yourself from it as well, because it's not about me and I can't make it about me, but it's very hard when you see, everyone's heart aches when you see a story about a child who's experienced something horrific.
Yeah.
But it's my job to put my own emotions in that aside. I don't have the answer for that. I don't know. If anyone does, I'm
but it makes all you, ears. It makes you good at what you do. You want to be able to have that. And people will know that they have, there's a, I truly believe that there's a thing in your voice, there's a look on your face that shows, I know this is awful that I'm talking about, and people will get that, and that's what makes you good at your job. What about how do you then turn up again the next day? What's the, do you have a decompression protocol? Like, do you have a something when you finish the day that
exercise is my slate cleaner. Exercise is my, is my non-negotiable. I need it. I need it for my mental health.
What's that look like for you?
It depends on the day. Running, I do a lot of running.
Nice.
Which is, to me, that's just the ultimate head clearer. I do some weights training, pump a bit of iron.
It's important. Lift heavy stuff.
I'm a lifter.
You got to lift heavy stuff.
And just walking, whatever, anything. Bit of yoga for half an hour at home. Yeah. I did that the other night. I hadn't done anything all day. I put the kids to bed and I did 30 minutes of yoga in the living room. I slept so soundly that night.
Right.
But I know, I can feel myself. I was sick last week, so I didn't exercise for a week. And by Saturday, I was saying to Pete, the anxiety is settling in my stomach. I need to go for a run right now. And I just did an easy 5Ks and I felt like a new person. That is my self-care, I suppose. That's how I kind of decompress and reset and move forward into the next day.
And it sounds like to me like you, despite you were unwell, but it sounds like as hard as you can, you try to protect that time.
I do, yeah. I try really hard to protect that time. And it doesn't always work. You know, sometimes you'll have a crazy week and you'll get no exercise done in a week, but I pay the price for that mentally, definitely. So I do. I try to protect that time as much as I can.
It's so important. I've been talking about it a bit lately because I think exercise got sold to me as this is a thing that people who want to be skinny do.
Yeah,
or this is the people who want to be fast or massive. This is what they do. If exercise has been sold to me as like, this is what people who want to not shout at other people when they're having a hard day do.
Yeah.
This is what people who want to be able to think clearly when everything's confusing do. Mm-hmm. I probably would have been way more into it way younger.
Yeah.
But it's sold to us as an aesthetic outcome.
Correct.
It's very rarely sold to us as a resilience outcome. Which ultimately it is because there are hormones that are released into your body that allow you to shift mood states far easier but only get released when you're putting your body under these conditions. Not super stressful. Like a walk will do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But we're not told that when we're little, which is kind of weird. Were you a sporty kid?
Really sporty.
Yeah?
And so I think that set me up for a lifetime of enjoying it. Yeah.
Right.
I played everything. You name it, I played it.
Water polo?
Yeah, did one season of water polo. Didn't like being grabbed out under the water, so I'm a bit of a wuss like that. So
gee, loved the water polo.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
Loved that it was, There's a fair, all the stuff that went on under the water was fair game.
Yeah, right.
And her and her mates, they were mad for it.
I was more of a netballer.
Ah.
I like the 3 feet, you know.
How's your knees?
They're fine.
Well, that's amazing.
Freakishly fine, yeah. I can't explain it. I played a lot of netball, did a lot of swimming. I did shot put. I did high jump. Touch footy, cricket. I was in the girls' first 11 at Brisbane State High.
Nice.
Yep. So coached by Mr. Marnie. I loved it. I loved sport as a kid, and I think that really set me up for life. Probably.
It really. I spoke with Liz Ellis on the show not long ago.
Hero.
Yeah, we basically spoke about that pretty much the entire time of how valuable sport is for young, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
It's the idea of, you know, that you can get good at something. You won't get good at it straight away. It's going to be hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, but you can do it and you'll adapt and other people will rely on you.
But also getting overlooked.
Yeah.
You know, I missed out on teams.
Yeah.
I didn't win the 15 meters breaststroke, you know, things like that. And
at Chandler. So you get,
at Chandler, yeah, yep.
Home of the 1982 Commonwealth Games.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I used to swim at the Queensland State Championships at Chandler.
Awesome.
I didn't do very well.
You got state. Come on, you got to state. Off it.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a lot of all those life lessons.
Yeah.
It's all there in sport.
Are your kids into sports?
Yeah, we've already got them. Tiger Dad, Pete has already got them into soccer, doing kickaroos.
Wow.
So, and they do swimming lessons. So swimming and
soccer. How are they going? Because Wolfie, the kickaroos thing, it was kind of hard.
It's chaotic.
It's like
chaos.
And he got there and he wasn't exactly that into it. And one of the, I'm the only dad there, one of the other moms came over and she says, oh, that boy there, right? He just cried the first 6 months and sat with me.
Yeah.
He never ever got out there.
Yeah, yeah. There are some parents I think, I don't know why you keep bringing them back. It's not going well. and it's hard because they do. There are some who just still cry through every class. But they're getting better now that Oscar's four. There are a couple of kids in there and usually they're their dads are English.
Right.
Very invested and they are incredible already at four. And my kid's running around like an aeroplane just doing circles, you know, in the middle of the field.
We had one or two of them. We had one who was Brazilian.
Yeah.
And he was just so crazily better than all the other kids.
Yeah.
The other kids... And I don't know, the kid's a kid, right? The kid just gets, he just reflects what's, you know.
Yeah.
A bit disheartening for the other ones, to be honest.
Yeah, it is.
Because they couldn't do the thing that this kid was doing.
Move them up. Why do they have to stay in the age group? Up a grade.
I don't know.
You know, let's be flexible.
I don't know.
If one kid is running rings around the others, they don't belong in that class.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had to start sending him to swimming with somebody else.
Yeah.
Because we were... if I don't do it, then I've got your attention.
Yeah.
So but now we send him to swimming with somebody that looks after him on one of the days of the week.
Yeah, right.
And he's nailing it.
Yeah, great.
He's nailing it because there's no point pork chopping for this lady.
Nah.
But for us, it's like, oh, I don't want to have my thing. But it's like, mate, you did it yesterday.
Yeah.
Come on, you were doing it at the beach yesterday. You can do it. You know how to do it.
Come on.
But I'm fascinated by it. I'm so fascinated by these. His little brain. I'm fascinated by G, you know, just how she approaches the world and it's so completely different to the way I approach the world when I was her age.
It's like, amazing. It's the best lesson ever.
Yeah.
Watching the world, we were so lucky we took our kids to Japan in January. My brother's wife, so my sister-in-law is Japanese, they go every January with their family, with their three kids.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we went and linked up with them over there and watching them experience such a different place. Experiencing snow for the first time, down a toboggan. It's the best holiday I've ever had.
Amazing.
You know, and you worry so much about taking kids out of their environment and out of their routines and all of that, but it was such a joy to watch them experience something so different and it makes you look at everything so differently.
Yeah, Japan's one of those places that you go and I found Brazil to be like this as well. It's like, thanks, Western culture. We'll take that and that.
Yeah.
Oh, and that. You keep everything else. We're fine.
Yeah.
And you go there and be like, oh, so trains can be this?
Yes.
Huh.
You can have onigiri in the 7-Eleven.
Wow. So hang on a second. So an entire community-wide, society-wide pride in our work because if I work well, it's good for you. Oh.
Amazing.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not me first in the gimme gimmies. It's, you know, I do this so we can do this.
Exactly.
You get a bit around that for a little bit.
Yeah,
And like an extraordinary capitalist country, like unbelievable economically successful from what happened at post-World War II through to the 90s. It's unbelievable what they pulled off by taking these tiny little bits of westernization and then going, we'll just apply this to these ancient principles of collective outcome.
I mean, what they have done with vending machines is just unreal.
Coffee everywhere.
Unreal.
Just everywhere.
Yep.
Coffee. So you name good. It. It's like, no, this sushi was made an hour ago.
I know.
And now it's in a machine in a Subway.
It's incredible.
And it's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So imagine being a four-year-old taking all that in. It's unreal.
No, none of the food would look like anything that these kids are used to. How did they go?
Oh, no, they went really well. So I've been taking them to the sushi train. I was taking them to the sushi train in the lead up.
Yeah.
So they were pretty across sushi and karage chicken, which, you know, is basically like KFC. And they can both murder a bowl of rice.
So there you go.
They did really well.
How were their chopsticks?
They were okay. The four-year-old plays around with them a bit. He goes okay.
Yeah.
The three-year-old was asking for a spoon.
That's right.
But the highlight for Oscar was a chip on a stick at Harajuku Markets. So, you know, You can take the boy out of Sydney.
It's
but
a taste of home. It's a taste. Yeah, it's a taste of home.
It's so good.
When you are in a job like yours, which is a job of some profile, people would ask you to support their cause. I'm sure somebody asked you for Taylor Swift tickets. Yeah. I didn't get asked because I'm not in the really music. I'm not in the music game much anymore. But I'm sure you were like your DMs. What can I please have? People want you to help their causes because you have a voice.
Yeah.
When it comes to choosing something that you help, where do you choose and why do you choose?
Well, I have a long association with Young Care, which is a Queensland-based charity. It's national in its reach, though.
Yeah.
And that came about through a couple of things. So, firstly, I did stories with them back when I was a reporter.
What do they do?
In Brisbane. They support young adults in Australia who are living with high care disabilities, high needs disabilities. Their focus for years has been on getting those people out of aged care.
Because that's essentially
which has been the
only
option for
these
such
people
a long
that need
time.
Such high care.
Exactly.
The only options they have is to live with a bunch of 75-year-olds.
Which is totally inappropriate.
And they're, you know, 14, 15.
It's totally inappropriate. And so they have for years been building brick by brick accommodation that is modern and bright and accessible and
with Wi-Fi.
And with Wi-Fi, exactly. Everything's touchpads and, you know, movable tables and everything. It's so refreshing to walk into a Young Care share house. And not just for the residents, but for their families too, you know, who've suffered watching their loved ones suffer in a place that is totally inappropriate for them. So they've done that, but they've also provided a lot of grants to help to modify the family home if that's what the family need and want. Through the NDIS, that is really shifting now, and a lot of young people are getting out of aged care, which is fantastic because there's more specialist disability accommodation available. So they're looking at other ways to support people who are living with high care needs. And crucially, they're working as an advocate for people with disability. I think a lot of, you know, in the shift to the NDIS, which is a crucial part of our country, a crucial lifeboat for so many Australians. There are more than 4 million Australians living with disabilities, and they are a crucial support network for those people and, again, their families. But there has to be still advocacy at a grassroots level. Yeah. There's a lot of box ticking that goes on and not a lot of advocacy. And that's where Young Care is really crucial in the community. So I aligned with them years ago through knowledge of them through working at Channel 9 in Brisbane, but also through my mum, who's a social worker, retired now, but was a social worker for her entire career, and dealt with Young Care through a lot of the people she worked with over the years. And she was such a big fan of the work they were doing. And I did go to her early on in my time on the Today Show and said, if I were to sort of align with someone, I'm thinking about Young Care, what would you say? She said, yes, you know, they're wonderful. They deserve the support. Do what you can for them, basically.
Yeah.
And so I guess in a way too, you know, my job at times, you know, there's a lot to it, but I feel like I'm not at the coalface the way a social worker is, a nurse is, a doctor is, a paramedic is, a police officer is, you know. And so in a way I guess it's kind of a tip of the hat to what my mum did throughout her career as a social worker in supporting people in such a critical way. And so I hope that's kind of a way to honour what she's done and to recognise the work that carers do in the community as well.
When you, like, I'm sure you get asked to do this sort of thing where you go and speak to a class of high school kids or something like that. When you speak to a group of young women who, and on a, you know this, it happens to me, I will go and speak to young people and I'll look in a room and then I'll go, you, it's you right there. And they're the one that come and speak to me afterwards.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that email me and they're the ones I'm like, yeah, sure, you can come. And I'm like, it's going to be you. When you speak to young people who are looking to pursue a career in this kind of space, what do you say to them?
I say be patient because things aren't linear. You will go on a roundabout journey to get wherever you want to go. And I also say keep your options open. You know, a lot of us, there's pressure put on us from childhood by people saying, what do you want to be? What do you want to do? Where do you want to go? And we have to have this answer ready for everyone.
Yeah.
I want to be a fireman, or I want to be a doctor, I want to be a lawyer. And I think you grow and evolve throughout your life, and different opportunities present themselves at different times, and you don't want to miss a great opportunity just because it's not what fits that path that you had set for yourself.
Yeah.
And you never know what's going to speak to you. You know, I've landed in roles that weren't on the plan, and I've enjoyed them so much, and I've learned so much in those roles as well. So you just never know what is going to work for you. So I always say keep an open mind and be patient, I think, because things don't just fall in your lap the way you want them to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what about, what do you tell them about work ethic?
Work your backside off. I say work your backside off.
Yeah.
Because you have to, you know. I mean, it's a balance, again, of knowing what you're worth and asking for what you're worth, but also putting in the hard yards and learning from everyone around you. You know, and that's the other thing too is, you know, in my business, you're more likely to learn the best stuff off the cameraman who've worked with every journalist, right, and every producer, and have seen best practice, work practice, and everything, worst practice, and everything in between. So you've got to be open to learning from everyone around you because everyone has something to teach you, and that doesn't stop. You know, I learn off David Campbell every day, right? He's just such a class act. I sit next to Dickie. I never take any of that for granted. You know, they've seen and interviewed everyone over the years, and they both have encyclopedic knowledge of news and pop culture and entertainment, everything. But I also work with a predominantly female production team who a lot of them are in their 20s, some in their 30s, and I learn so much from them every day. They're tapped into stuff that is not on my radar. I'm not on TikTok. I'm no longer
kids under the age of five.
X.
Come
I know,
on.
I don't,
what?
But it's not just that. It's, you know, they come from really diverse backgrounds. Yeah. They teach me so much every day. And so you've got to be really open to being a sponge your entire life and your entire career.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. If it wasn't for Brad Davis, Jim Walpole, Pete Mazzaferro, Michael Jackson, and lately Glenn Steer, these five camera operators, who mostly Brad.
Yeah.
Brad, when I first started, he just took me aside and said, "Hey, mate, thanks, man, I will."
Oh, yeah. Like,
amazing.
Yeah, the
best. You couldn't have said it better.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
When you came in and did the show with us at the Factory Theatre, well, I talked to Claire the next day. Claire, one of the cast, she's like, she can come back anytime. She was amazing.
Oh, so sweet.
No, honestly, and she didn't say that about everybody. So there's an open door. If you ever want to come and be a part of it.
I will be back.
We're doing the Melbourne Comedy Festival if you're down there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll have to to rearrange some things after so I can make sure I can be there.
I'm putting my special guest list together now. So already looks like keep it secret from the cast because they didn't know you were coming either.
Yeah.
I love it. But we had George Danikian come and do it.
Oh, wow.
And he said, "I'm only going to do it if I get to read the news with you."
Oh, that's amazing.
And I said, "Okay, well, I'm gonna write a script." And then he goes, "Yep, okay, you'll send it to me." "Yes, of course." And he goes, I said, "Now, George, I might put some things that are difficult to pronounce." And then he goes, "I wouldn't expect anything less." Because that was his thing. You know, when he was on SBS, was really ridiculous pronunciations.
Yeah.
And under the bus, I threw, and he's boom, like seven-syllable Indonesian
Still
town
got
names.
It. Amazing.
He was doing lines about, I mean, he was doing jokes about drug busted toilet cubicles. And like, he was so good. When I grew up, I want to be him.
Yeah.
He's so sprightly. He's 72.
Yeah.
And he looks maybe a year and a half older than me.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
I want to be that guy.
Yeah. He's going well.
When I grow
he's
up.
He's going well.
He was amazing.
Well, you have collected an amazing cast on that show. They are so damn funny. They're so smart. They're so quick. I just loved it. I loved being around them.
I'm so glad you came. And part of it, again, like part of it is I put the show together because there's this really ridiculous part of the job that you do and I do where we're all just kind of standing around in an empty, quiet room while we watch a red clock count backwards for 4 minutes. What are we doing?
I know.
What do we do?
Yeah.
And this the wild stuff that happens
in those moments. It's just when we're left to our own devices. It's dangerous. It's so dangerous,
And it's hilarious. Yeah. And it's a beautiful trope to play with. And it's quite open to. It's fun.
Yeah.
And I can't.
Well, you've
wait.
Created something really fun.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. Come on down if you're in. Like,
you got it.
Bring the kids.
Yeah.
You're the best. Thanks for making time for this.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
That was Sylvia Jeffries. She's on the telly in Australia every day, weekdays, 9 a.m., Channel 9. That's where you find her. She's great. She's super great. Thank you so much for being a part of the show. If you would like, you could follow me on Instagram. You can want to get in touch with me, just drop me a DM there or jump on the mailing list. You can find it at oshagensberg.com. Thanks to everyone that helped me make the show today. Thank you to Matt Sofo and Conrad Hendricks, who work on the audio post, Mikey Ward on video post, Ella Bramer-Jones, production, Toe Hider, who made the music, Monica and Ben for keeping the lights on, and you for listening. And that motorcycle guy down on Franklin Street. Thank you, buddy. Thanks for being a part of it. I'll see you Friday.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.